This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
State to come and bust these jobs, it's going to have a significance for other workers, because who wouldn't be next? I mean, if they can do this effectively to an organized union, they're going to be doing it to workers everywhere in this country. So really, we need to be asking ourselves whose job is going to be forcibly taken from them next.
So you want any parting words for our listeners, Latea Daly?
Yeah, the community is I hope, upset about this, as I am, and that they'll get involved. Occupy St. John's meets at Anna Bananas every Wednesday night at 7, and we're working on this issue. So is Jay with Jay. We're hoping to get other communities and other groups involved so that we can build the community fight back for this and show the longshoremen they're not alone. Because this really is our fight. These are our ports. We own them, and our communities are going to suffer if this goes down. So Occupy St. John's, Jay with Jay, they're great places for people to plug in if they want to help.
And how can people plug in with Occupy St. John's or Jobs with Justice?
We have a Facebook page, Occupy St. John's. We also have a WordPress site, OccupySt.John's.wordpress.com. Jay with Jay's got a website. It's jaywithjaypdx.com.
.org, sorry. Thank you very much, Latea Daly, Occupy St. John's, and concerned community member out here on the picket line with the locked out members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Jamie Partridge, KBOO News.
America's kill list. You've probably heard about it. Made in secret, no target off limits, including American citizens. Author and reporter Jeremy Scahill has been on the ground across the globe, uncovering the story of this change in U.S. policy. The award-winning author of Blackwater, Scahill is in town to talk about his remarkable new book, Dirty Wars. He'll join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, on Political Perspectives Wednesday morning, May 8th at 9 a.m. He'll talk about his decade of reporting on U.S. covert wars carried out by the CIA and the JSOC. Tune in and call in to join the conversation. That's reporter Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, on Political Perspectives, 9 a.m. Wednesday, May 8th, right here on KBOO.
Anti-abortion activists have passed dozens of laws restricting reproductive rights in state legislature across the U.S. recently. We have this update from Between the Lines.
Over the past few months, many states controlled by Republican governors and legislatures seem to be in a race to see who can craft the most restrictive abortion laws. The winner as of now is North Dakota, which passed a law limiting abortions to the first 6 weeks of pregnancy. So far, 10 states have passed bans after 20 weeks, 7 have gone into effect, while 3, in Georgia, Idaho, and Arizona, are being challenged in federal court. Meanwhile, 26 states have passed laws imposing new restrictive building code standards, specifically targeting abortion clinics, most of which are not related to patient care. And 4 states have recently adopted legislation requiring that abortion providers have admitting privileges at local hospitals. That law in Mississippi, if it goes into effect, would result in the closing of the state's only abortion clinic because doctors currently travel from out of state to perform abortions. After Kansas Republican Governor Sam Brownback signed a new anti-abortion law that declares life begins at conception, blocks tax breaks for abortion providers, and requires doctors to falsely warn patients that abortion can cause breast cancer, New York and Washington State are moving to ease restrictions with some abortion procedures. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Elizabeth Nash, State Issues Manager with the Guttmacher Institute's Washington, D.C. office. Here she discusses the success anti-abortion activists have had in passing dozens of new laws restricting women's reproductive rights in state legislatures across the U.S.
The action around abortion restrictions and bans has really escalated since the 2010 elections. And this year, I wouldn't say so much that the volume has gone up, but certainly the extreme nature of these restrictions has shown up in the sense that we are now talking about bans instead of burdensome restrictions. And I think what makes this 2.5, 3-year wave so interesting and so harmful is that the kinds of restrictions that we started seeing in the 80s and into the 90s, the waiting periods and the counseling requirements and parental involvement requirements, those kinds of restrictions, for the most part, have fallen by the wayside, and now we're seeing much more burdensome restrictions become law. I mean, in some ways, it's the same old, but for example, a waiting period that gets passed now is a 72-hour waiting period rather than a 24-hour waiting period. And now, this year, we are starting to see some very aggressive abortion bans. We've seen the North Dakota bill become law, and that bans abortion at 6 weeks of pregnancy. In Arkansas, we saw a ban at 12 weeks of pregnancy. And these bills are just incredibly extreme and very harmful for women's health. Women will not be able to access abortions in North Dakota should that law go into effect.
Many people, including some abortion foes, are saying these new laws would never pass constitutional muster because of the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade. What do you think about the legality of these new laws, and do you think any of them would survive a constitutional challenge?
What the Supreme Court has said is that abortion may be legal up until viability. The state cannot ban abortion before that point. And then after viability, a state may limit access to abortion but must include protections for the woman's life and health. And by viability, we mean when a doctor determines that a fetus can survive outside the womb, and that can be with some medical assistance, but it really is how far along the fetus is developed so that it really can withstand, it can survive outside the womb.
Elizabeth Nash, I heard an interview with the North Dakota legislator who spearheaded the passage of the extremely restrictive bill there, and she was saying that with all the medical advances in the past 40 years since Roe v. Wade was decided, the age of viability has shrunk so that younger fetuses can survive outside the womb. What do you think about that?
Viability in 1970 was considered around 26 weeks. Now we're looking at maybe 24, 25 weeks. So the difference isn't that much. There is a difference, but it isn't as big as some people make it out to be. And certainly we have had advances in medical science, but each pregnancy develops at a different rate, and each woman needs to be evaluated by a provider. That's why the Supreme Court did not say, oh, you can have an abortion up until 24 weeks. They picked viability specifically because each pregnancy develops at a different rate, and that seems to be a good demarcation of viability. So what we're seeing now and over the past couple of years are laws that would ban abortion at 20 weeks post-fertilization, which is before viability, and they have very limited exceptions that don't include what the U.S. Supreme Court meant by life and health. So we saw those for the past couple of years, and now this year we've seen this 12-week abortion ban in Arkansas and a 6-week abortion ban in North Dakota. Now, what we're seeing in the legal system are that some of these 20-week abortion bans are being challenged, and the Arkansas 12-week abortion ban has been challenged, and we're expecting a challenge in the 6-week abortion ban in North Dakota. And what that means is that we are going to have to wait for a couple of years to find out what the judges say and how these cases wind their way through the legal system. And so up until this year, people were really looking in Arizona, where there is a law that bans abortion before viability, and it is in the federal courts, and that was the law that everyone was looking at to be perhaps a challenge to Roe. Perhaps that would make it up to the Supreme Court. And now we have these earlier bans that are also going to make their way up through the legal system.
That was Elizabeth Nash, State Issues Manager with the Guttmacher Institute. For more analysis and commentary on the ongoing battle over reproductive rights, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Aho, I'm TJ Ravenwolf, Khoi Khan Athabascan, Muscogee Creek from Alaska. I'm here in Portland, Oregon. I'd like to invite you to an evening of Native American art, music, storytelling, and traditional indigenous foods. Come join us for the Indigenous Experience Northwest at the Scottish Rites Ainsworth Event Center on May 30th, starting at 4 p.m. Music starts at 7:30 with public speaking, art, storytelling. And at 7:30, upstairs in the ballroom, we have four Native American Music Award winners performing: Keith Sokola, Cody Blackbird, Swill Canem, double feature with Big B and Nate with the Brian Harrison Trio. For more information, go to the Indigenous Experience NW.com.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, the University for Grown-Ups, where it's never too late to earn a bachelor's or master's degree to achieve your dreams. Adults of all ages choose Merrill Hurst to gain knowledge from professors who practice what they teach. Now enrolling for fall term. Information at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. We live at a time of transition when factory farmed food from the other side of the world crosses paths with organics raised at a local CSA. The question many ask is, which direction leads us to a more sustainable and just food future? Our discussion this morning will challenge both locavores in their contention that everything local, because it is local, is best, as well as those who have said that only huge global systems can deliver food sufficient to feed our hungry planet. My guest is farmer and college professor Philip Ackerman Leist, author of Rebuilding the Food Shed. Philip is a professor at Green Mountain College in Vermont, where he established the college's farm and sustainable agriculture curriculum, and is director of the Green Mountain College Farm and Food Project. Philip, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me here, Barbara. It's a delight.
Well, it's fun to have you, too. I've been enjoying reading your book because I'm actually working on a film about a very similar topic, and so I was trying to get inspired.
Great. Well, it'll be fun to compare notes then.
And actually, I think that there's I found in reading your book that you hit on some serious conundrums, and I think I want to start with the one that I just laid out, the conflict between the only way to feed the planet in the future is through local, very local, 100-mile diet kinds of things, versus the only way we can feed the planet is by having industrial agriculture using chemicals and genetically modified crops and things like that, because the natural way doesn't work. So first of all, how do we kind of parse that to look at, is it an either-or?
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's an either-or. I think, you know, whenever we cast out these absolutes, we get in trouble no matter what side of the political spectrum we're on, or where, you know, whatever our views may be with regard to local foods, local food systems. And, you know, I think some of us have probably been a bit too purist in some cases in trying to push forward, you know, some of the local food agenda. I think we really have to recognize that we do live within a world in which local is nested within regional, which finds itself within national and international food systems. So, you know, it is complex, and I think we'll do a better job in building out these systems if we can really start to be more honest about the situation. And as far as the industrial agriculture is concerned, you know, the notion that we have to have that is, you know, also really problematic in my view, and I think there's no better place to look than the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania and look at the studies where they've done side-by-side, you know, conventional agriculture and organic agriculture for more than 30 years. And it's clear in that case, you know, organic wins, and that's good scientific research. So I think all of us need to be more careful and probably need to be talking to people who are at, you know, the other ends of the spectrum more often, see if we can find some good middle ground here.
Well, when I think about the world that we live in right now and the argument that we need to have this kind of industrial scale and not only just chemically modified but genetically modified food to feed everybody, and I peel it back to when I was a kid, which was, let's say, 40, 50 years ago, when you never considered eating asparagus in the winter or strawberries in the winter. I mean, it was right. We ate things seasonally, and it, in fact, I mean, it was the way that I was raised, it just seemed normal. And then, I don't know when it was, maybe 20 years ago, I started seeing all these strange fruits and vegetables in the supermarket, not actually not just in the supermarket, in the food co-op even, mm-hmm. and the local natural food store at all times out of season. And I started learning, oh, this, it's all because of refrigeration and stuff like that. And right. at that time, cheap fuel prices, that we could be eating things that came from all around the world. But then there was an issue that I discovered pretty quickly, which was I get that asparagus from Chile in January. It tastes like wood. I get those strawberries from California, which are raised not for taste but for shipping ability. They taste like wood. So there's a reason to be eating seasonally and locally. And I wonder if we can, if a part of rebuilding our food shed, as you talk about, is also part of us learning how to appreciate the importance and the necessity of eating seasonally, and that connotes actually eating locally.
Right. Well, you know, perhaps, you know, in a joking manner, we could consider all of it about palates and palates. It's both the palate and the sense of taste, which also I think is ultimately tied to nutrition very often, and then also, you know, the palates in which we're shipping things around all over the world. And, you know, the more we can do in order to build out these local food systems, I think the better. And, you know, it's just a given that the fresher the food, the more high it is, or the higher it is in nutritional content. So, you know, by knocking out this whole notion of taste, you know, we also take care of this, you know, a lot of the nutritional issues, and really reinvesting in our own communities. And things really start to be much more sensible when we look at it in this fashion. But it is an adjustment, you know, both of those kinds of palates.